Thanks for downloading from WRTI. This is Jim Cotter. For more information on this and all the other programming you hear on the station, go to our website, wrti.org. While you're there, you might consider becoming a member, renewing your membership, or making an additional gift. This podcast and all of the programming you hear on WRTI is made possible by our listener members. Why not become one now? Thanks, and enjoy the show. Hello, on this week's program, David Patrick Stearns reports on the rise and rise of Eileen Perez. The soprano whose career began in Philadelphia stars in the Royal Opera House's production of La Traviata. Susan Lewis takes a first look at the Philadelphia Wind Symphony. The new ensemble performs for the first time tomorrow. And we speak with Krishna Tyagarajan, the president of Symphony and Sea Orchestra. That's all ahead this morning on Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Philadelphia opera-goers have watched soprano Eileen Perez grow from an unusually polished student at the Academy of Vocal Arts to an even more polished leading soprano, not just in recent Opera Company Philadelphia productions, but now in Europe, where she's just made her debut singing Violetta in La Traviata at the Royal Opera House. She faced the critics on Monday, and Hilary Finch of the London Times wrote that Perez has now made the part very much her own. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns met with Perez in London after her dress rehearsal and reports that she was strangely unintimidated by the great singers of the past who have sung La Traviata on the Covent Garden stage. In fact, she finds their ghosts encouraging.
Eileen Perez seems remarkably at home backstage at the Royal Opera House. From the security guards to the chorus to people we ran into in the elevator, they seem to have known her for a million years.
Okay, fantastic. Okay. Yes. And I've invited my parents to the last performance. Good. I would like them to meet you.
Yes, it's a pleasure.
Great.
Yeah.
Bye.
Okay. Who's that?
Peter Katna. He does the casting here.
Going down.
Going for a tour.
Mind the doors. Doors closing.
Pretty, talented, and considerate of everybody around her, Perez endears herself with something more subtle. She's a listener. You can see it on stage. You sense her character making decisions at that very moment based on what's going on around her. She looks fellow singers in the eye. There's a personal energy exchange. That's not typical in opera, where singers often stake out and guard their turf. Perez, in contrast, is excited about singing with a top-flight cast, if only because she doesn't have to worry about them.
There's nothing better than being next to a great singer that, I mean, it makes you feel better in the sense that you know you don't have to be nervous for them. You can fully sing out. You don't have to worry about them. You worry about yourself, and you know their level of excellence makes everyone play better.
In such company, Perez is able to make new discoveries in a role whose steep vocal demands are matched by the psychological ones. Portraying a terminally ill courtesan who suddenly meets the love of her life, Perez was uncovering fine details as late as the Act 3 dress rehearsal when she arrives at a party on the arm of an elderly baron.
I felt something new today where I realized my music, Voi Barone, is actually very formal, you know, Voi Barone. I've never been on stage with a baron who was decorated. And I think I will be even, hopefully, more aware of my surroundings, the less I'm concerned about singing it, how much it frees you up to just take in the room, the energy, the playfulness.
Thank you.
Eileen Perez unashamedly admits to a more superficial source of inspiration, her dress. When the production was new in the 1980s, Angela Gheorghiu became a star in that dress, both on stage and on the cover of the subsequent recording.
I didn't realize when I came in for a fitting that it was, you know, the 1994 George Schulte, Gheorghiu, Big Richard Eyre production until I saw the black dress. And I just remember because that was on the cover of the album. And I thought, oh my God, this is it. You know, I just thought, oh, this is, I'm on top of the world. And I warned everyone here that if it goes missing, you know.
Success in London isn't new to Eileen Perez. The Traviata excerpts heard here are from a recital she gave there in 2009. She has also sung with the Royal Opera, though on its 2010 tour of Japan. She was pressed into service when the scheduled soprano was too ill to continue her Traviata on opening night in Tokyo. Her final curtain was greeted with an audience roar, according to members of the chorus who were there. Perez probably wouldn't have mentioned it unless I had.
I'll never forget that moment. It was definitely a spectacular evening in the sense that I've never seen a public that happy, that appreciative and on their feet. And I think it speaks hopefully to my performance, but also it should speak of how everyone just made it all work. You know, what I remember beyond the ovation, when the curtain came to a close, then the chorus and everyone else congratulating me backstage. So it was another roar, and I'll never forget it.
That's why she seems to belong in a place that many singers aspire to, but few reach. Having grown up in the Chicago area, Perez trained at Indiana University in an opera department so large that promising singers sometimes get lost. But she didn't. The Academy of Vocal Arts is no picnic either, but she not only won leading roles right away, but met her future husband, the also up-and-coming tenor Stephen Costello. Now, the two intersect with each other all over the world. Only a few days previously, Costello arrived to join Perez in London, where he'll head the next Traviata cast, singing opposite Anna Netrebko, among others. But what about the ghosts of singers past?
They're my heroes. Maybe they kind of used to haunt me, but now I think they're my courage, too.
In moments like this, you want to stop, stand back and snap a mental picture of Perez and Costello walking through London's West End at dusk, the streets decorated beautifully for Christmas, with Costello looking for a place that he knows will deliver the perfect burger. Success for both continues and continues. So do the pressures, artistic and personal. But that's for another day.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The term band music is often associated with marches or popular American favorites, played in schools or at holiday celebrations, or during sports games and military ceremonies. But ensembles of wind, brass, and percussion instruments can perform a wide variety of music. Now, Philadelphia has a new group of amateur and semi-professional musicians that aims to build on a tradition of familiar band music while embracing new repertoire and presenting concerts that go beyond the stereotype of what a band is. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers the Philadelphia Wind Symphony, which plays its first concert tomorrow.
People have been making music with their breath for centuries, and many of us today have a wind or brass instrument in our past. Maybe still in its case in the back of the closet or under the bed. Conductor Virginia Allen, a faculty member at the Curtis Institute of Music and the University of the Arts, who has a history of service in military bands, founded the Philadelphia Wind Symphony partly to fill a void.
I kept running into people around the city who had played an instrument at some time. There are a lot of people that play high school and into college, and once they graduate, they don't really have an ensemble to play with.
Allen reached out to people like horn player Brittany Devereaux, who studied music in college but now works for an HR consulting firm.
I don't know if I was the first, but I felt like I responded right away, like, yes, yes, please.
Devereaux is also chair of PR and marketing efforts for the group. Its general manager, Keith Rockley, is a high school music teacher who plays piano and can pick up a trumpet if needed.
There's a large number of music teachers actually in the ensemble. It's really nice to be back in the seat of the performer. In the short amount of time I've been doing this, it's helped me in my teaching to remember that, oh, things are different on the other side of the stand.
While the word symphony refers to a large-scale musical composition, it's also been claimed as a name for ensembles that perform the genre, usually orchestras. So what is a wind symphony?
It's a group of musicians who play woodwind, brass, and percussion. And I decided to use the term wind symphony because it's a smaller type group.
Smaller at around 50 musicians than a concert band, which can include over 100 players. Wind symphonies often have one player per part.
I also chose the name Wind Symphony rather than the Philadelphia Band because some people are turned off by the word band, and they immediately think Sousa marches or pops music. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's beautiful music that's written in both of those genres, but some people don't realize that there is this whole set of repertoire that's as serious as any orchestral or chamber music that you would want to hear. And it explores different colors than you're going to hear in other kinds of ensembles.
Music written for bands often does reflect its roots in the armed forces.
The military decided that they wanted to have bands to support the troops and to maintain the morale of the troops.
Beyond marches, for years, much of the music that a band would play in concert had been transcribed from orchestral works. In 1994, Morten Laridsen's popular choral setting of the liturgical chant, O Magnum Mysterium, was also arranged for band.
There are moments in there that are very, very intimate, but then at the high point in the middle of it is this glorious moment that just everyone opens up and plays a nice full round sound, and it's a nice set of contrast between it, and it's this big warm sound that's coming out of the ensemble.
It can also be tricky, says Alan, who has done transcriptions herself, to give lines written for voice or strings to winds.
You have to realize that the instruments themselves and the players don't have the same kind of capabilities. And there are little techniques that you can use sometimes to be able to pull the music together. It's identifying the right instrumental color that will match with something in the strings, and then really being able to balance out the dynamics as well.
In this version of Dvorak's Carnival Overture, the clarinet section plays lines written for strings. ''1909 was a watershed year for the wind ensemble repertoire. English composer Gustav Holst wrote one of the first symphonic works for band, First Suite in E-flat.
It's a chaconne, which is a type of fugue, where the bass line keeps repeating, but he introduces his theme in the tubas. And it's this very nice, very lyrical theme. It's just for 8 measures, and it sets up the whole rest of the movement, and it's amazing to hear with those 8 measures all the variation he goes through. Every color is explored.
In the second movement, it's very chamber-like and very intimate, and I love the second movement. I would just like play it over and over and over again. The third movement is more of like a British march.
And one of the other things that he did in the last movement is to use some folk songs in there. So that makes it the kind of tune that you can go away singing.
Over the last century, more composers have written explicitly for winds, with growth in the repertoire fueled by commissions from colleges as well. Contemporary composers, in turn, have looked for new possibilities that this instrumentation allows.
Even new instruments, especially back in the percussion section, a lot of wind ensemble pieces have really pushed the envelope with new instruments and using instruments in different ways.
People are always exploring the combination of sounds within wind ensembles. There's a piece, Ecstatic Waters, by Stephen Bryant, where they'll even have the Australian hoops that you whirl around, so you hear the sound of the wind in there. Just all sorts of colors and sounds that you can combine in there. To have the capability to combine that maybe with some of the traditional music is really very exciting.
The Philadelphia Wind Symphony aims to celebrate both tradition and innovation. The group is working with the University of the Arts, which provides space and the possibility of multimedia presentations involving student singers, dancers, and other artists.
I see endless possibilities of different things that we'll be doing, not just people coming in and seeing an ensemble sitting on the floor and playing, but a lot of different creative ways to collaborate with other performing artists.
No matter what you call it, an ensemble of brass, woodwinds, and percussion can still get feet tapping and arm swinging at holiday celebrations or sports events, in military barracks, and in concert halls. A band or wind symphony can also be a canvas for complex new works, a place where instruments we've known since childhood take center stage and explore music in a new way.
WRTI Susan Lewis. The Philadelphia Wind Symphony performs its first concert tomorrow afternoon at 3 in Gershman Hall at Broad and Pine Streets in Center City, Philadelphia. Krishna Tyagarajan took up the presidency of Symphony in C just over a year ago. He came from the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra, where he was Director of Artistic Operations and Education. There he made significant contributions to artistic planning, finance, education, and audience development, all skills that were to prove useful in Camden. In his first year there, Tyagarajan has made massive progress in turning an orchestra that's always been artistically sound into a more significant presence both regionally and nationally. He's doubled the number of regular season performances, doubled the number of children's concerts, increased philanthropic support by 50%, while increasing earned income by a third. All this in a consistently economically deprived city, at a time when other similar orchestras are contracting or even going out of business. Tyagarajan began his second season as president of Symphony in C in October, looking forward to continuing the orchestra's forward progress.
Last season, we had 8 concert performances. This season, we're going to have 15. A lot of that is due to growth in the contracted services area. So these are concerts that are actually being contracted by other parties, or these are our collaborations with other organizations.
In the past, you had this ongoing once-a-year concert with Astral Artists. I can't think of any other regular collaboration. What's new?
This season, in addition to our existing relationship with Astral that's strengthening, we are also collaborating with the Mendelssohn Club Choir here on Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia. We are also working with AVA. The soloists for our Mozart Requiem will be from AVA. The choir will be Mendelssohn Club Choir. And we're working with, of course, Roberto Diaz, president of the Curtis Institute. So, yeah, Curtis Institute is really an organization that Symphony in C wants to do more with because we have the same mission. The mission is America's next generation of musicians, and Curtis provides their training, and Symphony in C is the practical application, and then they move on from there.
The other, I guess, leader in your field, if it's not putting it too strongly, is probably the New World Symphony in Miami, who've made enormous strides in a new building and a lot of financial and community support in Miami and indeed from around the country. Artistically, you're creating on a level that I would suggest is similar to theirs. What are the possibilities for all the other ancillary stuff that they have that you don't have?
My focus in this first year was really to make sure that the symphony performs as many concerts as is possible and as is fiscally prudent. When we talk about the ancillary stuff, we talk about buildings. We talk about all kinds of classes and workshops that take place in those buildings.
And lots of technological toys.
Yes. I think the history shows right now that you need to be very good at managing that sort of overhead expense. There are a lot of orchestras in this country that have recently moved to newly constructed halls and are beginning to feel that that is a very large increase in their overhead expense 10 years down the road. Basically, we're being very prudent in that and very careful. Long term, I wouldn't rule anything out. I would have been surprised to be able to tell you beginning of last year that we could almost double our concerts within 1 year, in especially a fiscally challenging time as this still is. I know I said this last year, but for many people, it still feels like financial troubles haven't ended yet. Symphony in C had to do a combination of a few things. We had to cut some production costs, and we had to also raise some funds. But we managed to have a balanced year at the end of the year. For us, the year ended on June 30th. And so we are not going into this year with any long-term debt or any major problems, and I would like to keep it that way.
Going forward, you have some ambitions to perhaps take the orchestra on tour. Is that just a rumor?
No, it's not a rumor, although it's too early to talk about specifics, but I spent my annual vacation this year in Europe. I am from Germany, that's not a secret, and I was talking to some people there, and within the next 2, maybe 3 years, it is a possibility for the orchestra to go overseas, again, pending the ability to secure the necessary funds to do so.
If we were to give you the magic wand or crystal ball, where would the orchestra be? Well, say in 3 years, along with this idea perhaps of touring, will we see a more expanded season? What are the ambitions?
I think what we would like to do is we would like to add a second venue for our Philharmonic subscription concerts. And there are some talks going in that direction. Again, it's a little too early to give you specifics, but we're looking north and we're looking south at some locations for that. The reason being that obviously we want our musicians to have the chance to play the program that they rehearsed so well, not just once, but twice. If we could do it 3 times, that would be perfect too. We would like to expand the Philharmonic season perhaps by 1 extra concert. We would like to make some of our early collaboration efforts that we are having success with this year, we would like to make them annual or maybe every 2 years, that we'd return to some of these organizations across the river. So that could mean an expansion in Philadelphia from currently 1 annual concert to maybe 3 or 4 per year. We would like to become the choice orchestra for recording for modern music. We're currently in talks with a number of composers who are, we're developing recording projects with them. And this is largely to do with the fact that we're so successful in our Young Composers Competition contest, most of whom get picked up by Presser Corporation and get their music published. But we're also on the Eastern Seaboard in one of the most prolific productive areas of people composing music, Paul Moravec being one of them, Philip Glass is here. So we're basically wanting to make sure that we become the orchestra of choice for these composers if they want a high-level recording done at a budget that makes sense, and then make sure that this recording actually gets distributed.
And that it is a Symphony in C recording.
Yeah. And it's not because we want the glory of being on a recording. I want to make that very clear. The reason why we want to be in that sort of business is because we want our musicians to have the experience of working in that professional environment. If I had my choice, we would have the normal symphony orchestra component to it. We would have a recording component to their training, and we would also have, obviously, opera as part of that, because opera is sort of the chamber music for the large orchestra, where you really have to listen, you have to follow, you have to interact with what's going on stage, and there's a lot of anticipation of what's going on stage because you can't see it. So it's great for your skills as a musician. So these three components are very, very important. On a smaller level, what we want to do is we want to offer workshops to our musicians that are not just based on their training and their instrument, but based on how you conduct yourself in professional life once you leave university. How do you put your resume together? If you are entrepreneurially minded, how do you start a small music festival? All these kinds of skills, when I graduated from Indiana and then with a doctorate from University of Maryland, There was a little bit of that going on, but there really isn't enough going on in today's environment, because today's environment changes so much more quickly than what was going on 10 years ago, and you have to be prepared for that.
Symphony in C President Krishna Tyagarajan. The orchestra performs works by Vaughan Williams, Mozart and Mendelssohn in a concert this evening at 8 at Rutgers Camden Centre for the Arts. And that's our program for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony in C under music director Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.